You're listening to The World Cafe and The English Beat are our guests today. We'll get to a great live concert recorded by the present-day Beat at World Cafe Live in Philadelphia. But first, we'll get the history of this ska revival band from Birmingham, England, that was at the center of the two-tone musical movement in England in the late 70s and early 80s. As we talk with Dave Wakeling, who along with Ranking Roger fronted the band, which also contained Andy Cox and Dave Steele, who formed the Fine Young Cannibals when the band split, and Saxa, the original ska saxophonist, who was a good 30 years older than the other members. To get a feel for how this all came together, I asked Dave Wakeling to give Americans an idea of what it meant to be from Birmingham, England at the time.
Being from Pittsburgh, probably, basically, okay. Or being from Detroit. It's that kind of industrial, urban grit. Sense of humour in the pubs on the night, because the weather's kind of rough a lot of the time and industrial work's kind of rough. So there's this general sense of hearts of gold and all suffering together and a huge degree of irony.
Now, I know, who do I know from Birmingham? I know The Move.
Move, Moody Blues, Black Sabbath, Judas Priest, half a Led Zeppelin.
I'm getting the feeling.
Yeah, Dexys, UB40, Duran Duran.
Now, everybody talks about the Beat, the English Beat, having so many wide influences on one band. Did everybody kind of grow up with the same things, or did people have different things they brought?
Totally different. Mm. And if that was some ways that was one of the blessings, and in other ways it was the curse. Everybody had a whole total different set of influences, and it was like watching six spheres try and converge on each other, and sometimes you'd get this perfect little ellipse in the middle, and then the planets would shift again and it would be gone. There was a whole mixture of different stuff that people liked, between punk, reggae, soul, and in fact, when we did Tears of a Clown, which ended up as the first single in England because it was Christmas time, seemed the perfect song. We'd actually done it because we were having such trouble making our new songs fit together with everybody's influences. And so the drummer, Everett, said, why don't we play something that we all know? And when we can play that one right, we'll try one of your weird ones, like that mirror thing, should we? And it took us about 10 minutes to find a song that we all knew. That was a sign of it. And Tears of a Clown was the first. We're like, oh, yeah, I know that one. Of course, everybody knows that one. But, I mean, Saxa was in his mid-50s, right. Late 50s. Roger was just becoming 16.
Wow.
David Steele was 19. Me and Andy were in 23 or something like that. Everett was in his 30s, early 30s. So the chances of us...
Pretty disparate.
The nice thing, yeah, pretty disparate. It would have been a good, disparate and desperate. So in some ways it was a blessing because we didn't have those sorts of peer group arguments. It was like, well, he thinks differently from me. It was like, yes. And your point is...
Now, how does Saxo become part of the group?
We used to drink down at this pub, the Crompton Arms, in Handsworth. And there used to be quite a lot of old boy Jamaican style musicians playing down there. And he would start playing and you'd forget where you were. You'd just become mesmerized, hypnotized. It was like, wow. And if he was in a mood, the vodka was flowing like wine. He would just play solos endlessly and the band would just follow. So the special said, would you like to do a single? We said, yep, Tears of a Clown. And we said, why don't we ask that crazy old guy if he'd like to play saxophone on it? That'd be good. And we went down the pub and asked him. We had a gig the following night in Birmingham University. Said, well, why don't you come down and play the gig, just, you know, busk it, and we're going down Saturday to make a single. Yes, okay, he said. So we came to the gig, and he arrived just as the gig was going to start, so... no chance to talk about anything. And I was like shouting the keys across. It's in B, it's in A. He's like, me know all the keys, man. Yeah, right, just play. And he did, and he just turned it upside down. At the end of that gig, he said, this is the group I've been waiting for all my life. You watch, this is going to go straight to the top. We're like, yes, thank you very much. Would you like another vodka? And he was right, Sozzler.
Well, let's play the song that they, the only one they could decide on.
This is
Tears of a Clown. Beats version, or the English beat here in the States version of Tears of a Clown, and I'm talking with Dave Wakeling, and I have to tell you, Dave, as a DJ, I played a dance once, and I put that on. Most everybody's out on the floor dancing, but one woman came up to the stage, she was screaming, says, "No, no, no, you're playing it at the wrong speed." And I thought that was perfect.
Yeah, exactly. We had, at first run of shows, we did, I think, a lot of college shows in 1980, and I had a girl student come up to me and she said, "Do you know somebody's already covered your song?" I was like, "Really?" She said, "Yes, that Tears of a Clown, but it's really slow. You can't dance to it." I was like, "Bless you."
Well, the English beat and the two-tone scene and ska in England at that time was far more than just a bunch of music. It was very much, and you'll have to tell me more about it because I wasn't there, but very much seemed much more of a social scene and an identity for a lot of people. Was that true?
It was, yeah. In many ways, I suppose, sometimes things come because they come in reaction to something, you know. There was this, unemployment was rampant, 17% in the country, 25% in amongst minorities, and although they were getting blamed for taking the jobs off white people, right? That's always a good one. And because of that, there was this fermenting right-wing, it's almost sort of Nazi-ish kind of vibe developing, and they were recruiting young skinheads off of the soccer terraces. You can manipulate and use working class angst in a number of different ways, can't you? Mm. So, really, in some ways, these two things were happening at the same time, and two-tone became, as it were, then an answer to this attempt at forcing racial division. I think it was probably the last attempt to prevent multiculturalism, a bit like preventing the tides rolling in, you know, the King Canute of social sciences. And it ended up becoming a political statement. Now, where we came from in the industrial Midlands, there'd been lots of groups with black people and white people in them. There was, just in the same way as on the factory lines, so we didn't realise there was anything special about having people a different colour in the group. And nobody mentioned it when we played in Birmingham or played in the Midlands. The first time anybody mentioned it was when we went to London and they liked it. "Oh, that's all right, isn't it? Like black geezers and white geezers, same group. I like that." It's like, "Oh, well, okay, well, if you like it, we'll use it then. Smashing." And then by the time we came to New York, I suppose, in 1980, it was like as if it was a sociological point we'd made and the music was just like a soundtrack to it, the theme song to this treatise of ours. And we were like, "Well, okay then, yes, fine." We would do stand by that anyway, so if it turns out to be an important thing, then all the better, you know. We found over the next couple of years that if you'd got a multiracial crowd, all wearing similar fashion style clothes, all dancing the same sort of steps in time with each other, it was very difficult to try and organize a race war on the following Monday.
Well, you know, that was actually part of what I was talking about, was the fashion that came out of it. And the graphic sense of both Two-Tone and you guys was very, very similar. And I guess my question, one of the questions out of that, there's a lot to talk about there, would be the Beat Girl, your logo,
yeah.
Where did she come from?
She was required to keep some order in the dance hall, to be honest, because when we first got involved with the two-tone scene, specials and selector gigs, it was quite male, quite skinhead and mod, and quite violent. In fact, it was almost like a good working class wedding, you know what I mean? It wasn't really a proper do unless somebody had had a fight. And so we were a bit shocked by it. It was like, whoa, what are we going to do about this then? And I said, well, if the two-tone man had a girl to dance with, he'd probably behave himself better, you know, and that might affect the skinheads who come into the dance, because they might start showing off to the girls instead of showing off with each other, which has a different effect on any man, but a skinhead particularly. Okay. He'll stop headbutting people because, you know, that's not going to get you laid. And well, you know, dress up a bit better. So they sort of wore their strutting clothes rather than their combat dress. And it worked tremendously. Within the first, say, 3 months, there was all loads of girls dressed as the beat girl at the front of the stage, and loads of skinheads and mods and suede heads, like, circling them like birds of prey. And they completely forgot about trying to break each other's nose before the encore. It was tremendous. Then the other two-tone groups got all jealous. There's no fights at your gigs. How'd you do that then? I was like, thank the beat girl.
That's so great. Okay, the things I have to check in on. For instance, Mirror in the Bathroom, great song. And actually, we have a chance to play a new version.
Oh, great. You got that from Michael. Yes,
yeah.
Good. Yeah, we made a version with Rick Torres from Supreme Beings of Leisure, who's playing guitar with me, has been now for a couple of years. And I just thought he was a genius. Then he told me he'd grown up on the beat, and then I knew why.
What's the story of writing that, though?
Mirror in the Bathroom.
Yeah.
Not wanting to go to work on the construction site, snowing, had to get on the motorbike. Not great. So if there's leaves on the ground, snow on top of it, you know, you might have had a drink, perhaps an extra half a glass of sherry that evening before, you know how it goes. And the clothes were still wet. So you'd put them in the shower and hang them up so at least they'd be wet and hot when you put them on. And there'd be sand all the way up to the knee on the jeans, you know. So you're like, oh, good, yeah, sure, I can do this. Have a shower. Let the shower keep running so the room's getting really steamy now. And then go to the other end of it and I'm having a shave. And I could see, in the mirror, I could see the little catch on the door. And I just said to myself, we don't have to go today, Dave. We could just stay here, just me and you. Look, the door's locked. I began this little conversation. But then the dream was soon over. The shower had to get turned off. The wet clothes had to be put on the motorbike, going to work. And I started to think about that notion of it. And some of the bits I'd said, the door is locked, just me. I was like, ooh, that sort of rhymes, doesn't it? So I kind of cheered myself up on the way to work.
Well, this is that new version of Mirror in the Bathroom, Mirror, Mirror from the English Beat. English Beat coming up on the World Cafe. We're talking with Dave Wakeling from the English Beat about some great history, some great times, and there are more songs I have to know about. Well, I want to know, first of all, your reaction when you did come to the U.S., because whether it was purposeful or not, there was certainly politics involved with what the Beat was doing. And the U.S. whole, even the U.S. punk scene, was not as political as it was in England.
Right.
And what did you think when you came here along those lines?
I noticed immediately the difference between the pogo and the mosh pit. The pogo is in fact a very cooperative dance where you jump up and down vertically and other people would get their hands under your rib cage and push you up higher into the air. So it'd be kind of like the Watutsi, if you will, or any NBA game. And you'd be just bouncing upwards and down, and it was very exuberant, and people did bang into each other, but that really wasn't the aim or the intent of it. Then when I first came over here, I noticed the mosh pit seemed to be a little bit more like a training video for NFL. So people would wait until somebody was on one leg and then slam into them with their shoulder. But it seemed a bit more like what I'd seen the Hell's Angels at Altamont or something, that shoulder smashing dance they kind of did.
Absolutely.
And so I thought that was a bit odd. It had sort of, well, punk had kind of degenerated into oi by the time I'd come over to America first anyway. It didn't seem to have the element of sarcasm that I thought was required to fully appreciate where Johnny Rotten was coming from, you know? Or that, yeah, where he was coming from. So that's got to disturb me a bit. But I suppose it was like, it's like any music fashion or trend and that. When it gets to the end of it, it can sometimes be a bit unseemly, can't it?
Well, if you've been hearing me, I've been bouncing back and forth as to what to call this band. Because I noticed, it's either later this summer or at some point, you're doing an extensive tour of England. And I would expect in England, you're simply the Beat.
Yeah.
Yeah, and here in the U.S., you're the English Beat. And some people may not understand quite why that distinction.
Yeah, there was a band that already thought of the name in San Francisco around the same time, but they'd got the rights to it in America. And we knew nothing about it until I got a phone call in my apartment in Handsworth. And it was Bill Graham, the Bill Graham. And he said, oh, I hear you have a band called The Beat. And I was like, yes, that's right. He said, well, so do I, so you can't come to America with it. I was like, ah, oh, no. And then he went on to say, well, have you got management? And I was like, no. He said, well, if you're looking for American management, I think I might be able to help you get the name. And I should have just said yes, shouldn't I? I should have just said yes, but no, I was a punk. I was a punk. I was like, that's disgusting that you'd sell your own band out. I said, well, what if you were managing us and we were the Beat? You'd do the same then for the next group that wanted to. No way. I was like, oh, no, you idiot. But anyway, we came to America and we were meeting with the record company and had a breakfast before we went in, and we got to come up with a name. We tried to call ourselves the Beat Brothers, which we thought sounded like a Philly soul band, which we liked
soul
a lot.
Soul Brothers 6, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Really? The Beat Brothers, hey? And they didn't like that, the record company. So we ended up, that was what the publishing company got called, Beat Brothers. And they had some problem about, like, the Blues Brothers. I was like, what? So Beat Brothers, we couldn't do that. And we're all confused at breakfast. And we noticed English muffins, which, of course, are not called English muffins in England, just called muffins. And we're like, they seem to like the word English over here, don't they? They don't like the word British, but they like the word English. Like, the British reminds of the Empire, but English reminds of roots somehow. We were like, well, what about the English Beat then? We were at our sort of toying with it and not convinced. We mentioned it in the record company and they went nuts. Oh, my God, that is so great. English Beat. The English Beat. Oh! So that was it.
You know, speaking of coming to the U.S., there are things I discovered reading up. I was assumed that Save It For Later was your biggest hit. And I find out that in England, that was like a disappointment. But here, it was the other way around.
And it's funny, there's a whole back-to-frontness about that, really, because I wrote it when I was 18. Yeah. I wrote it a long time before the Beat ever started, but then it ended up on the third album.
Because it wasn't right for what you were doing originally?
Some of the people in the Beat thought it was a bit too rock and not enough ska. And then the record company prevailed because they'd fell in love with the demo, and after 3 or 4 years, they were like, you're nuts. It's got to be on the next record. That's it. We're just not going to listen to it.
Save it for later. Our thanks to Dave Wakeling for talking with us. We'll go on stage at World Cafe Live with the English Beat and maybe even hear another version of that later on. We'll get right back here to the World Cafe.